It's with sheer delight that Sunil and I welcome you to our home. Maharaj, Dr. Desai, Radha Krishna Das Prabhu, and each one of you today to our home. It's a real pleasure to have you all here, and we are really blessed to have Maharaj here with us today. You know, while I find myself completely incompetent to introduce Maharaj, I must share one thing with all of you, that Sunil and me, we've been going to ISKCON since 1983, but we met Maharaj a few years back at Dr. Desai's home. It was a moonlight and a beautiful, beautiful ambience on his terrace. And after meeting him, we thought it was really magical. And we do hope that each of you who are here today will feel that magic. Just to tell you a little about Maharaj, Maharaj's spiritual journey began at the age of 19 while on a summer trip to Europe, which culminated in a commitment to search for something more in life. As a penniless hitchhiker, he traveled through Greece, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and finally came to India. Here, he lived as a wandering ascetic, first amongst the forest-dwelling Himalayan sadhus, and later amongst a variety of gurus and spiritual practitioners throughout India and Nepal. Ultimately, he was led to the holy town of Vrindavan, where he found his path amongst the bhakti yogis. Apart from being the spiritual light and leader for ISKCON, Maharaj has directed a number of acclaimed social action projects, including midday meal programs run by Radha Krishna Das Prabhu, which daily serves sanctified vegetarian food to underprivileged school children. He has also worked to establish missionary hospitals and eye camps, eco-friendly farms, schools and ashrams, an orphanage, and a number of emergency relief programs throughout India. Today we request Maharaj to share with us some of his experiences from his spiritual journey, which he has beautifully documented in the book, The Journey Home. We would be also giving you a copy of that book today. So for those who have not read it, we would highly recommend that you read the book. And Maharaj, thank you once again for blessing us and our home.
I am very grateful to be with all of you. Thank you, Sunil and Anu, for opening the doors of your beautiful home for all of us. It's always a treasured wish in my heart to come to meet your beautiful friends. And thank all of you for coming and going through the hardships of Mumbai traffic to get here. So I think I'll discuss this subject tonight. How oftentimes it is challenges that even shake us to our very core, that open the doors to the road of transformation. I was asked to speak something about the book I wrote, The Journey Home. So I'd like to speak from this perspective. I began this journey not really knowing what I was looking for or what I would find, but I knew I had to make it. In the 1960s in America, for young people especially, it was a very turbulent time. From my early childhood, I was born in 1950 in Chicago. It was the law. We'd begin every day in school by offering allegiance to the flag of America. We put our hand over our heart. I haven't done it in a long time. And we pledge allegiance to the flag. And the little prayer that we would say began, "One nation under God, with liberty and justice for all." And as a little child, I really believed. I believed that. But then when I was about 8 years old, my father and mother, who were born and raised in the Great Depression, where most of America was actually in severe poverty, they worked hard, came out of it, and started a business. My father was the largest dealer of Edsels, a certain model of the Ford Motor Company, in the whole of the Midwest. And the Edsels went totally bankrupt. My father lost everything. My mother stood with him and took care of three wild boys, and got another job, and I grew up watching her cut little coupons out of newspapers to get like 2 cents less for potatoes and whatever. So when I was just about 15, I got a job because I wanted to help my mother and father. I was in high school at the time. And the place I worked, myself and my friend Gary, we both were together, everyone else was my parents' age. And they were all African Americans from the south side of Chicago. And they became my good friends. But I saw what life was like for people who happened to be born another color. This was in the mid-60s. If you were born with a black skin, 99% chance you would be born, suffer, and die in the ghetto. There were no equal rights. They were in poverty. They were discriminated against. They couldn't go to good schools. Couldn't get good jobs. In the depression of their lives, there was so much crime and anxiety, and they were all alcoholics just to deal with it. And when I would look at the flag and say liberty and justice for all, I was thinking, it's not for all. There's something wrong. Pained my heart. At the same time, I was of the Jewish faith, my family, and people told me they hated me because I was Jewish. A lot of people hated me. And these were people who hated me in the name of God. The south part of America was very religious Christians, and they were strongest in segregation among races. So why is there so much hate in the name of a loving God? And why in a nation that symbolizes liberty and justice for all, There's so much discrimination, hatred. So I joined the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King. I read books of Malcolm X. My friends, their elder brothers, were being forced to the Vietnam War. And many of us, we really didn't believe we should be there. The government could not convince our generation with a single argument that justified us killing and being killed for this war. But yet, when you turn 18, if you're a male, if you get drafted, which was forced, you had three choices. Go and kill and be killed for something you don't believe in, or go to jail, or secretly escape from America and probably never be able to come back. Many did. They went to Canada. Some even came to India. So these were all burning questions for me. And I came to a conclusion that if I really want to, as Gandhi said, be the change that I want to see in the world, there has to be an inner transformation. There has to be a change of values. There has to be a deeper understanding of who I am and what is my relationship with other living beings. So I began to read different spiritual books of all the different religions. And I decided, because I saw so much hatred and so much prejudice in different sectors of all the religions I was studying. And at the same time, I was seeing so much beauty. So I came to the conclusion, I either have to reject spirituality or I have to find an essence that's common in all the great spiritual traditions and live for that essence. And somehow I just had this inherent feeling that there was that essence. When the Bible says you should love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself, I believe that everyone's our neighbor. It's not a matter of what sex or what color or what religion or even what species. Wherever there's life, it's sacred. Wherever there's life, there's a child of God. If we love God, we will love our neighbors. So I wanted to find that. But it wasn't as an academic study. It wasn't out of curiosity. It was because my heart was really pained by the world around me. And there was a sense of urgency. I had to find it. That was my life. Hunger is actually a feeling of necessity. But according to the Ayurvedic medical tradition, without hunger, you can't digest food. You can't really assimilate the nutrients in food unless you have good appetite. So somehow or other, I was really hungry. Not for food for my stomach, but food for my heart. So I was praying for direction. And people around me, they were trying to solve it through revolution. And I was a part of that. peaceful demonstrations and violent demonstrations. And people were taking drugs and alcohol and so many things. But I didn't see that really as a foundation that could really make a change. So one day when I was in that condition of yearning and longing and really disturbed, my best friend Gary, he called me. I happened to be in Brooklyn, New York at the time. I hitchhiked there to meet a friend. And he said, "You have to come to New Jersey to meet me. There's an urgent subject I want to discuss with you." So I went to New Jersey. My friend Gary, we grew up from 10 years old. We went through so many transitions, from playing football and baseball, to going to college, to joining the civil rights movement and the counterculture. So I went to New Jersey, and he said, "In 3 days, I'm going to Europe with Frank, who was a common friend." He said, "You must come with us. We're going on a summer vacation for 2.5 months, then we'll be back for college." I told him, "Gary, I don't have any money." He said, "I don't either. Frank's going to pay for both of us." So that was a good argument. I said, "All right, I'll go." So I went back to Highland Park, a village near Chicago, and told my parents, "I'm going to Europe." They said, "No, no, you can't go." And I said, "But I am. But I'll be back in 2.5 months. So I left, and we arrived. We took an Icelandic airline flight from New York to Iceland, then to Luxembourg. And the first day we were there, Frank demonstrated how he was sponsoring us. The three of us slept in a one-man tent in a campground. And the next morning, there was a waterfall close by, so we went there, and when we came back, Frank accidentally left all his money in the tent, and it was not there. Somebody was very happy, and it wasn't Frank. So he said, "We have to go back. We can't make it here with nothing." So Gary and I looked at each other and said, "Well, we'll see you later, Frank." And he returned, and Gary and I were in Luxembourg. We didn't know anybody, we didn't have any money, but we were happy. And we had a tradition, because we wanted to go so many places, but we didn't know where to go first. So we would stand on the roadside and hitchhike, and wherever a person picked us up, they'd say, "Where are you going?" We'd say, "Where are you going?" And that was our tradition. Wherever that person driving was going, that's where God wanted us to go. So we went through Europe. And as we were going, actually, we were extremely popular. This was in the summer of 1970s. Because for American hippies, they were very prestigious in Europe at the time. They considered us very authentic. So we were making so many friends, and I was enjoying so many things like never before. But there was an emptiness. There was that calling away from all of it. And I ended up kind of departing from Gary and going to synagogues and monasteries and cathedrals and forests and riverbanks, and then meeting Gary later. I was becoming more deeply obsessed in my spiritual thirst. And eventually, it's a long story, but it was out of certain reversals that led us to live in a cave in the Isle of Crete, which is part of Greece. And I would climb a mountain. Every day, from sunrise to sunset, I would pray, I would meditate, I would read various holy books and philosophical books, and I would cry for direction. I really didn't know who God was, but I believe he heard me. And Gary would do the same thing on the seashore. One day on that mountain, I saw a beautiful sunset. The sky was orange and tangerine and purple and red. It was beautiful. It was reflecting on the Mediterranean Sea. There was beautiful mountains turning purple in the sunset. Birds were singing and flying. And it was such an awesome display of nature. I felt so close to God. And I was crying, God, give me direction. And I heard a voice. It was a silent voice. It spoke three words. And I really believed, and I still do, that it was God's voice answering my prayer, responding to my tears. But I knew if I follow what it said, I had to leave my whole life that I knew behind. The three words were, go to India. So I climbed down the mountain, went back to the cave, met Gary, and I said, Gary, he was sitting there, it was now dark, there was a little candle, and he was meditating. It was a nice cave, actually. I said, Gary, something incredible happened to me. Gary said, something incredible happened to me. I said, what? You won't believe me. I said, no, I will believe you. Tell me. He said, no, no, you will not believe me. I said, just tell me. He said, I heard a voice at sunset. What did he say? Gary said, the voice spoke three words. Go to Israel. I said, where? He said, I told you you wouldn't believe me. I said, no, no, I believe you. I just didn't hear. Where? He said, Israel. We should both go to Israel. I said, Gary, he told me to go to India. Gary said, India? That was the last word. There was about 20 minutes of total silence. We were just looking at the stars in the sky. And I remember speaking to one of the stars. I said, I'm willing to go. Then I turned to Gary and said, at sunrise tomorrow, I'm leaving for India. And he thought I was completely crazy. He said, hitchhiking through Europe is one thing, but to get to India, you have to hitchhike through the deserts of the Middle East. It's very dangerous. I told him I believe God is calling me there. So the next morning I left Gary in the cave and started hitchhiking to India. It was quite a transformative experience. to Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. It took about 6 months. And I met many wonderful people and many people who didn't like me at all. I got many diseases, but I was just so excited because I had faith that I was going to be given something that I was crying for. And ultimately, I was studying Islam while I was going through the Middle East. I had a wonderful teacher, actually, in Iran, Mashhad. And finally, 6 months on the road, I came to the border of India. Can you imagine how excited I was? I had to walk through a no man's land between Pakistan and India. When I came to the border, it was just a simple little border in a forest, Ferozpur, Punjab. I showed them my passport and I had a visa. And I was thinking, just on the other side of this lady at this desk is the yogis and the rishis and the sages and the lamas and the Ganges and the Himalayas and the ashrams and the monastery. I was so excited. And she asked me a question, the one question I dreaded. How much money do you have? So I looked through all my little, I had just had one little cloth bag, and I looked through it and I took out everything I had. I remember what it was 26 cents in about five different currencies. And she was angry as fire. She said, you must have minimum $200 to enter India. And she rejected me. I begged her. I pleaded with her. I was crying, but she was becoming more and more angry at me. She said, we have enough beggars here. We don't want another one. I don't know if she wanted a bribe or if she just didn't want me. But I only had 26 cents to bribe her. That wasn't enough. But there was a problem. She rejected me, but I couldn't go back to Pakistan because I only had a one-way visa. And I couldn't get in India. And the no man's land between, there were no buildings, no houses. It was just like a little field. There were no cell phones in those days. There was no telegraph office. So I had no way of contacting anyone. So I prayed, and I went back thinking that God will answer my prayer. But he answered it in a different way. She was more angry. She had her guards put guns in my face and tell me, you are rejected. There is no possibility you're ever coming into my country. Out. So about 6 hours passed, and then the sun started setting, and a jeep came, and another guard, and she drove away. But before she drove, she pointed to me sitting in the field, and she told this man, obviously, don't let him in. Then she drove off. So I approached that man. He was a Sikh. I was 19 at the time. He was about 50. He had a turban. He was very tall and strong. I walked up to him, very timid, handed my passport. He wouldn't even take it. He said, "I have been ordered by my commanding officer to reject you. Go back." I pleaded with him. And I cried. Not artificial tears, for real. I was in total desperation. I begged him. I said, "Someday I'll do good for your people if you just give me a chance. I've risked my life, I've left my home, I've left my education, I've left everything to come to see your country and to be with your people. Just give me a chance." He looked at me with one of those very intense, interrogating looks that immigration agents could give. And then he spoke. He said, "Although my commanding officer ordered me to reject you, sometimes a man must follow his own heart. I am going to give you the chance that you're crying for." And he took my passport and stamped it. And he put his hand on my head, because he was big and I'm still little. And he said, "May you find what you are praying for. Welcome to India." And I crossed over the border and it was dark. And it was just a field. I was just walking through fields. And I didn't know to turn right or left. I didn't know a single person. Actually, in America in those days, there were very few Indians. The first Indian I ever met in my life was the immigration agent on the border. Never ate Indian food. Never even saw a chili pepper. But here I am walking through these fields, and I just felt so at home. And later, a few days later actually, I was in the Himalayan mountains. I began in Haridwar and then Rishikesh, and I was traveling through Himalayas. Sometimes I was living at ashrams with rishis and yogis. Some were famous, some were very unknown. Sometimes I was living in forests and caves with yogis. But most of the time I would just go off myself in the forest. One yogi, Kailash Baba, taught me how to live in the jungle. How to eat, how to sleep, how to live with our neighbors, leopards, elephants, boars, snakes, mosquitoes, scorpions. And the most difficult were other sadhus. How to deal with them, because that's, you have to be a sadhu to understand the internal politics. But he taught me all these things. And he taught me that one interesting lesson, that here you are a guest. And the snakes and the leopards and the animals, this is their home. He said, if you have the slightest fear of them, or if you have the slightest arrogance that you are better than them, they will kill you, and there's nothing you could do. You have to see that you are not your body. You're not a human. You're not a man or a woman. You're not black or white or red or yellow. You're a part of God. You're a child of God. You're an Atma. Atma means the soul. And if you understand your own spiritual nature, you will see that the living force within every living being is your brother or sister. That spiritual person that's seeing through the eyes and hearing through the ears and smelling through the nose and touching through the flesh and thinking through the brain and loving through the heart, according to the Gita, is eternal, full of knowledge, full of happiness. And that happiness is its inherent natural love. Love for God. And when you love God, it's like watering the root of the tree. That water goes to every part of the tree. When you love God, you will love every part of God. And every living being is a part of God. You will see the leopards and the panthers and the scorpions and the cobras as your brothers and sisters who have equal rights to you in this jungle. What to speak of the other sadhus? So it was interesting because I was thinking what the Bhagavad Gita is teaching is really the foundational principle of equal rights. It's not just a subjective perception according to who we are and what we want, but to actually see and understand the essence within ourselves that's universal to all. Because when that love is awakened within our own hearts, which is our nature, it manifests as compassion, true compassion. It's interesting, because just because I was with him, and he had so much faith. People told me he was 150 years old. But he looked about 65. I was 20 then. But he had been living in the jungle since he was 12 years old. And because he had such faith in his own spiritual identity, he was fearless. And when I was with him, I was actually fearless. We were seeing these different snakes and animals, and I was just, if I respect them, they will respect me. And it actually worked. Sometimes they'd crawl over me while I was sleeping. I'd wake up and I'd just go, oh, my friend. They'd look at me and go, bye. But when I wasn't with this person, I started getting afraid again. But that's the power of association of enlightened people. It can really give us a transformation. So anyways, I traveled so many places with so many different types of people. Sometimes with Dalai Lama's monastery, sometimes Mother Teresa, sometimes different yogis. And about a year later, I happened to be in Nepal, in a village called Swayambhunath. It's just about 5 kilometers out of Kathmandu, in the valley. It was the month of August. I was walking through a rice paddy field. I saw huge clouds form in the sky because it was the monsoon rainy season, and I knew it was going to be a massive downpour. Well, I was looking for something to find protection, because I only had one set of clothes. The first day I was in the Himalayas, one sadhu approached me on the bank of the Ganges and told me to offer my Western clothes in the river. And he gave me the robes of a sadhu, which is just like this actually. But it was white. It was old. I think it was one of his old pairs. And that's all I had. So I was looking for a tree, but in rice fields there were no trees. I was looking for a house, there was no houses. And it started drizzling. And then there was thunder and lightning. I was just looking anywhere for some protection. And I saw what appeared to be a little old man walking with an umbrella. And you know how rice paddies are in the monsoon rainy season. They're really muddy and thick. And there's just a little border you could run on. So I was running. And I got right behind this person with the umbrella and walked behind him. And he was walking and it started pouring rain. And I stayed right close to him. About a half hour, we walked together. And because the rice paddy was, the border was so slippery because of the rain, he never turned around to look at me. We were the only two human beings, as far as the eyes could see, walking under the same umbrella. Then the rain stopped. And I was going the wrong direction. So I said, thank you. And the person turned around. He gasped. He was so shocked that his umbrella fell in the rice, in the mud. It was my friend Gary. We had no communication for about a year. There were no cell phones in those days. And I never had an address. And I had no idea if he had any address. Huh? So, you have to read the book to find out. But I never forget the first words he spoke. He said my name, I said his name. We were absolutely shocked. We were literally the only two people as far as the eyes could see. We embraced, and then he said, no one will ever believe this. And then we walked together. And he did go to Israel. After I left him, there's some things that I didn't write in the book that I'll tell you. But after I left him alone in that cave, he was really lonely. So he was walking down the beach wondering what to do. And he happened to meet the high school queen and the captain of the cheerleading team in our high school, who was like the most popular, beautiful lady, and she happened to be walking down, and he invited her to live in the cave with him. And she did. So we definitely took different directions, you know. I became a sadhu, and but I guess that didn't last too long. So he worked on a boat that went to Israel. And he lived in Israel and got jobs there for almost a year and then took a bus to India. It was called the Magic Bus. So we met. And it's a long story, but soon after that, we got lost from each other again with no way of possibly contacting each other. But I eventually came to a place called Vrindavan. And there I met so many beautiful people. And this path of bhakti. Bhakti means the yoga or the spiritual path of devotion. Just by living with the people there, it was so simple, yet so philosophically deep and complete, that I really felt that I found my path. What I found in it was something very inclusive. And Pramod Kumarji, earlier this evening, he was talking about how there are so many temples in India, but real spirituality is not just about worship, it's about education. And I found that true saints, especially in the past in India, temples were places of education. They were places where we learn a philosophy, a teaching, and a lifestyle that transforms us. That transforms arrogance into humility, greed into generosity, envy into compassion. Agitation into deep peace, prejudice into love. True religion, true spirituality is where that transformation takes place. And whether it's a synagogue or a church, a temple, a masjid, or whatever, we associate with people and we learn knowledge that actually helps us to understand our own essence and be transformed. Once my guru, Srila Prabhupada, who I met in Vrindavan, and who's although I met many people with deep and great teachings, his spirit of compassion was so profound. I just wanted to be a part of it, and I wanted to assist him in whatever small way I can. But I remember him saying that philosophy without good character is useless. That real education, spiritual education, teaches us how to live, as the Bible says, in this world, but not of this world. To actually, whether we are bankers or government officials or artists or engineers, whether we're in business, or whether we are mothers or fathers or students, or even if we're swamis, whatever our particular position in society is, we should lead our roles in an exemplary way, with a purpose, with character, with compassion. When we connect with that love for God, with our own true reality within, then everything we do, it's an expression of that compassion. And in my own journey, I felt that was the greatest need in human society. It's not a shortage of money. It's a shortage of insight of how it should be used. And the temples of the past and some in the present, that's the purpose, to give this universal spiritual education, transformation. When we chant these beautiful names of God, that's our understanding, that it helps. It's like tuning in to our own essential spiritual nature. And once we tune in, then we transmit that same divine energy. After some years, my visa for India expired. Actually, it expired long before. But you'll read about that if you book. It was quite an adventure. But everything was nicely arranged. And I returned after years of being away from home. And I went to visit my mother and father. And when they saw me, I'm going to end with just this little note. I left my home as a troubled, disturbed 1960s hippie college student. And I returned as a hardcore, seasoned ascetic from India, a sadhu, I hadn't slept inside a building for years. I only slept on riverbanks, under trees, or caves. So when I came to my parents' house, it was a culture shock for me. And when they saw me, I was gone for years. They said, "Where's your suitcase?" And I just had one begging bowl. I said, "This is it." So I was a culture shock for them. But somehow or other, my mother, such a sweet, wonderful lady, because in my letters to them, I told them that I was a vegetarian. And when I came home, I saw in her kitchen was a whole library of vegetarian cookbooks, just so she'd make me happy whenever I'd come home. She made me happy. But while I was there, I realized that our real home is within ourselves, where we find God within ourselves. Then we understand that wherever we are, we have our family. A journey home. It's not a geographical quest, although that may be the form in which we may or may not pursue it. But the real journey home is to find what is within ourselves. Thank you very much.
Maharaj will take some questions.
I'm in your home, so I'll be honored to take questions.
But before we request for any thoughts, any views, any questions. There is one person here who was most interested in today's program, Maharaj. And he's come straight from the airport. He came he took the earlier flight from Delhi and came straight from the airport. Mr. Gandhi is here. Why don't you? I kept this one for you, Mr. Gandhi, if you can welcome Maharaj for offer garlands to him. And finally, since you talked about bankers, there are lots of bankers and the banker regulators here. You've been always very kind to HSBC. And therefore, because you've been speaking at HSBC in India and in UK, both at London, if I can request a steward to offer garland to you on behalf of HSBC. Mrs. Gandhi has been really wanting to meet you since long. Any, Bhavi, any thought?
I think I'm pretty loud here. In fact, when Maya gave your book to me, I remember 3 years ago, it was a fantastic thing. And I was craving to meet you, and it has happened today. It was a very enjoyable spiritual journey, I should say. I was talking to my colleagues. I'm a professor, I'm a psychologist. So my only want your opinion, your part of this, because you're far ahead in terms of spirituality and
Experience and knowledge. Maharaji, what do you think about rebirth, reincarnation? Because that's something which is always in my mind, maybe as a psychologist, maybe as a human being, I don't know. What would you say about it?
The Bhagavad Gita speaks quite elaborately on the subject. And the principle that is described is, from what we were speaking, that the soul, the living force within us, is beyond birth and death. And this is a universal principle. In the Bible, Lord Jesus says, "What profiteth a man who gains the whole world but loses his eternal soul?" The soul is forever. The Gita says in Sanskrit, "Na jayate mriyate va kadachit, na hanyate hanyamane sarire." That the soul is without birth, without death. The body is like a car, and the soul is like the driver. We're seeing through our eyes like we see through the windshield. We should take good care of the car. Ayurveda, Hatha Yoga, all different types of ways to keep healthy is to keep the vehicle we have in a very good condition. But what spirituality is really for is to teach us not only to how to keep the vehicle in good condition, but to understand its highest purpose. And to somehow or other harmonize whatever we do with that highest purpose. The highest purpose is to realize our own spiritual identity, our relationship with God, our relationship with nature and with all living beings. So the soul is the witness of this body and this ever-changing mind. If I were to show you a photograph of myself as a little baby, you would not recognize, because the body is very much different. And what was my mind then? I was just thinking of my mother's milk. I haven't thought of that for a long time. So we go through so many transitions within life, but we're the witness. So according to the Gita, there are 8,400,000 species of life. That number is actually given in the Padma Purana. And these different species are different facilities for different conditions of our desires and our activities. So the concept of karma. Karma is a law of nature. Just like there's the law of gravity. Whether you believe in it or not, it's still going to be the same. Yes, if I say I don't believe in gravity, still it's going to go like that. So the Bible says, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. There's a law of science. For every action, there is an equal corresponding reaction. So this is a law of nature. If we cause harm to others, in a matter of time, that harm is going to come back to us. If we do good to others, in a matter of time, that good is going to come to us. So this is karma. If we misuse things, ultimately we lose those things. If we invest properly, it's like many of you are bankers, so you understand how important it is to invest intelligently. Well, that's what the law of karma is. If you do immoral activities or harmful activities to others, you are investing in a very, very bad stock that's going to really cause you problems in the future. If you do good things, you're investing in prosperity, where you're going to get rewarded. So according to our life, the karma that we create due to our actions and our words, and the desires and ambitions and state of consciousness that create through our karma and through our choices, that determines the destination of the soul after it leaves this body. It could be born into a higher, more prosperous environment, or a more challenging environment. According to our desires, born of our choices, and according to the withdrawals that we have to get through our investments. So that's called destiny. We make our own destiny. You see, the way karma works is you have a choice what to do. But once you do it, you have no choice what the reaction is. I have a choice if I'm going to get on a plane to London or to Australia. But once I get on the plane and it takes off and it's going to London, and I say, actually, I want to go to Australia. I have no choice. So we have a choice of what we're going to do or say, but then the reaction is going to come. So reincarnation, which is actually called the transmigration of the eternal soul. But the essence of the Gita is that if we make our choices in this life to realize our own true identity, bhakti means to love God and to live in a spirit of service and devotion to God. Those activities have no karma. That's investing in our eternal liberation. And when that love of God comes, then we have no more karma. Then we're liberated. And we connect. We, at the time of death, in our life we connect with the intimacy of God, who we believe is the supreme all-attractive person, who's the source of everything that exists. And then, whether we're in this life, or whether we go to the spiritual world, or whether we come back into this world, our happiness is to serve with love. That's the state beyond karma. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Maharaji, I would like to share something about the question that Joshi has asked. I'm Dr. Joshi. I'm also a retired professor of engineering college. I would advise us to read a book of Swami Ram Sukhdas Ji. There is a book published by Gita Press Gorakhpur, written by Swami Ram Sukhdas. He never would give his photograph on any of the books. But if you read the book, Punar Janma Ki Kathayen, everything would be solved. Because he has taken so many examples of different people in this country only. When a person is born in Lucknow, and at the age of 8 or 9, he goes to Bihar and he says, I died at this place, he was my father, he was my mother, and that proves that there are a number of examples of rebirth and reincarnation. So that is a very good book. I would recommend her to read that book. And Swamiji, I often go to Los Angeles. I have gone to Chicago a number of times, and I have seen those places, as you said earlier, the conditions of black people in America, I don't find much difference even today there, because those people still live in poverty and sometimes they are neglected, because I see them in the parks and other places. But of course, your experiences are very great. We have got high respects for that. We would like to follow all this. But then I didn't find much change today also in US about this discrimination and all that. This is my feeling. Because I almost every year, I was there for 6 months. Last year, again, I'm going in the month of January to LA for 5-6 months. My son is there. And I roam about in different areas. I try to see different people. And in our country also, there are many evils. But in US also, I find there are a number of evils like discrimination and all that. This is my opinion.
There has been great progress in opening doors.
Yes.
In the 1960s, when I lived there, because I kind of came to India in 1970 and never left India in one sense. But it was an impossible, inconceivable thought that an African American would ever be the president of the United States. What to speak of a mayor of a city, or a senator, or a congressman, didn't exist then. There are dozens of mayors, there's a president, there's hundreds of councilmen. So there has been a lot of breakthroughs, but still has a long way to go because there's a very deep history of...
Real democracy exists there, because last year also, some discussion was there of black people, of Christians, against the Hare Ram Hare Krishna mission in Los Angeles. 5-6 months ago. But they simply made slogans, they shouted, nothing happened. Because police force was so strong in that area, and democracy really prevails in that country, this I observed, because those people could only shout slogans, but after some time they went back. Against Hare Ram Hare Krishna movement only, there was an opposition of those people. They came in 100 or 200 numbers. They shouted for about half an hour or so, and then they were made to go back. So real democracy exists there too. This we could realize.
We all have the choice to be part of the solution or part of the problem.
Yes.
real transformation takes place in the world when more and more people are inspired to be a part of the solution. So there's infinite hope in every situation if we see the spiritual reality behind everything.